Like I work for the television.
Okay, I think we're ready to go. Good evening. As I said to you just a minute ago, my name is Jim Reed. I've been hired by the city to facilitate this meeting. They would like me to do it on time, so we'll get started right now. We are here tonight. It is part of the update of the Shoreline Master Program, a very early stage here in the process. The city's primary goal for our meeting tonight is to hear and to learn from all of you. The city is just now beginning to define what are the issues in this master program update. What are all the issues that the city needs to incorporate it into the update and to then address and examine in detail? Part of the process of learning about that is to understand what issues did you come here tonight to flag for the city, to talk about what are your interests and your needs and your concerns. So the primary purpose of tonight's meeting is to really learn from you. A secondary goal for this meeting is the city wants to provide you some context. For example, why is the city embarking on this process right now? I think there are two good reasons. The first is that it's been now 20 years, or even more than 20 years, since the last time the Shoreline Master Program was developed and adopted by the city. So now there are over two decades of experience and information that need to be assessed to understand, is the program working in the way it was expected? Is it achieving its goals? Are there some things we need to do to refine it? And the second major reason for embarking on this process is that the state recently adopted new guidelines for shoreline management. And they are asking, as the state does, or that's a code word for requiring, counties and cities to come forward and update their shoreline master programs to meet or to comply with the new state regulations. So that's why we are here tonight, to begin this process. As a real quick overview about how does tonight's meeting fit into the process, and I think the mayor and others will talk about this in a little bit more detail, but just to give you a sense, we're early in the process, we're just defining the issues, the whole parameter of this process will be finalized sometime later this year, and this is your opportunity, one of your opportunities to help define those issues. Next year, early in 2007, the Planning Commission will get to begin to update the program and have even more public involvement. And then sometime in the middle of 2007, it's expected that the City Council will take up this issue. And I believe the city's goal is to have an adopted Shoreline Master Program, or an updated program, by the end of 2007. One other piece of the program and the process is to take it to the Houghton Community Council and then to submit it to the state. And it's the State Department of Ecology that will have to look at the city's proposed updated program and then finally make a call that it is in compliance with the state's different guidelines. So actually this process has until 2009, but as I just said, the city's intention is to send it or submit it to DOE by the end of this year. So again, tonight's program is an early opportunity for all of you to tell the city, what is it that you care about? What do you are you most interested in? What issues do you think the city should really put into this process? You should all have an agenda, right? Does everybody have one? I just want to walk you through it real quickly. Then maybe if there are some, you could go grab a couple in the back or out in the hallway and bring them to people too, because a couple people here don't have them.
They were supposed to be stuffed inside.
I just want to walk you through the agenda real quickly, just so that you know how we're going to proceed tonight. In a moment, I'm going to have the pleasure of introducing the mayor. And after he has talked a little bit about, again, why are we embarking on this process and how does it fit in the bigger picture, we're going to have a series of presentations. And all the panelists are here right behind me. Michael Kogel and Patrice Tovar, Amy Myers and Joe Berker. You have, just to expedite things tonight, you have their biographies on a little sheet that was attached to the agenda, so I won't go into lengthy introductions of them. But you can see in session three of tonight's agenda the kinds of questions that they're going to address for you. And I would like to just ask, how about if we hold questions, and if you have pen and paper and you can take some notes, let them get through the presentation. They promised to hold it to 45 minutes. And having heard them, I think there's a lot of things that are kind of dependent on each other. So if we can let them make their presentations, we'll then have gotten kind of a picture from the city's perspective. Then we'll take a break, and then the next part of the program, the most important part, is for all of you to be able to ask questions of clarification if there's things they said that you didn't quite understand. We have a question here. What is really important to you about the shoreline? And that's kind of a little bit about, well, what are your vision and your values? And then finally, what issues do you advise that the city incorporate into this process as it updates the Shoreline Master Program? And then at the very end, about 9:05, we'll do a little summarization, like what were some of the key themes we heard tonight? What are some of the common interests? That kind of thing. And then Patrice will take you through more detail than I've just done in terms of what are the next steps and the next opportunities for you all to be involved in this process. And then we promise you that we will adjourn precisely at 9:15. So does that seem pretty clear how we're going to use the evening tonight? And is that okay with all of you? Does it meet your expectations? Okay. I just want to make one more point. If you look up at the map here, this process is not just confined to the city's boundaries. Let me see if I can use this for you. I'll use this little taser light. It also includes this whole potential annexation area. So you see the St. Edward State Park. This process will address both the city of Kirkland as well as the whole potential annexation area from Northeast 132nd Street all the way to that park. So that will be part of the process too. So if any of you live there rather than inside the city's boundaries, welcome, and the city needs to hear from you as well. So that was my final point of clarification. So with that, it is my great honor to introduce you to you the mayor of the city of Kirkland, Jim Lowinger.
Thank you, Jim, and thank you all for coming. I think one of Kirkland's strengths as we embark upon these processes is that we are able to bring out good numbers from the community to take part in this. That is where we always begin a success, and I think Kirkland leans heavily back upon the process side of government. Sometimes it's slow and sometimes it's cumbersome, and it could be even annoying, but we know that when we go through the process, the product we get at the end is one that we can all stand behind. Jim covered a lot of the thoughts that I had, so I'm going to kind of work around them. But I want to ask first, how many of you are here as stakeholders from the area that is currently Kirkland? And living in Kirkland. Sometimes there may be property owners that have property that don't live in Kirkland, but if that's indicative of being part of Kirkland, that is fine. Now, about from the annexation area. Okay, one. Yeah, I think it bodes well for us to be noting that we are also talking about the annexation area. I was talking with Paul before the meeting, and indeed, Kirkland will be more than doubling if and when we annex a potential annexation area, we will be doubling our waterfront area. I think it's almost trite for me to say, for those who have been in the room for the last 20 to 30 minutes when we had the rolling scenes of Kirkland's waterfront there, it would almost be trite to say that Kirkland has a long heritage of being proud of its waterfront that we have. And we will certainly look to maintaining and enhancing what we currently have and what we potentially could have in an annexation area. The reasons that Jim mentioned for us doing this, I think, are clear. It's been 20 years, and I believe, Patrice, that was our first Shoreline Master Plan. Is that correct, about 20 years ago?
In the early 70s.
In the early 70s. So not only is it a state requirement, but it's time for us to do this. And it's time for us to go back and look at the vision, gather on the vision, and see what can be done with today's technology that we have. That's changed dramatically in the last 20 years, as the shoreline has changed dramatically in the development on it in the past 20-plus years. Now, some of the thoughts that we can come out of this with, I think there's benefits. The fact that we can actually listen to all of you and begin to get comments and look again at the vision and produce another report of what we should be doing, what you like with the master plan, or the shoreline master plan, what you don't like, how it can change, is definitely a benefit. the new technology that we have to catalog much of what we currently have, and potentially, and some of this might resonate with some of you, how we can streamline the permitting process on shoreline master plan would be a benefit also. Now, what the Kirkland City can do for you is give you a completely transparent process, something you can trust that all of your comments are guaranteed to be listened to, guaranteed to be acted upon within the plan as they make sense. And by the time we complete and take all of the comments and combine it with the new science that we have, we should be able to have a document, have a plan that balances the environmental aspects of the shoreline master plan along with the economic and with the societal goals of our waterfront and our shoreline, that not only produces a vision that we all can gather around, but also one that adheres to the requirements of the state. So thank you for coming. Appreciate the process, and we should move along right now.
Great. So with that, thank you, Mr. Mayor. With that, we'll just go right to our panelists, and Michael's going to start us this evening.
Great. Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. Quick show of hands. How many of you either own property or are living on the lake right now? How many of you that don't would like to? It's really a tremendous asset, isn't it? And it really defines what Kirkland is. What I'd like to do is go through just a series of images real quickly just to kind of get us in the mood for talking about our shoreline. And I'm going to start with some historical context of Kirkland's changing waterfront over the years and kind of working from the south and a little bit towards the north. This first image is of what we now know, of course, as Carillon Point, one of our larger mixed-use developments, not only in our community, but certainly on the waterfront. Many people may not be aware that this was really one of the prime industrial areas of Kirkland's history. The Lake Washington shipyards, a number of ships were built here, in particular around World War II. So that area of our community certainly has changed over the years. Downtown Kirkland, Moss Bay, the old ferry dock where folks would go across the lake to work. Visitors would come from Seattle to Kirkland. A lot of people were looking to buy land at the turn of the 20th century. Certainly has changed quite a bit since Kirkland was first settled. Juanita Bay has been a tremendous asset for our community, set aside as a wildlife sanctuary. Some folks may not be aware that there used to be a 9-hole golf course there. Juanita Beach Park, which the city took over ownership from King County in 2003, has for many, many generations been a destination beach resort for Kirkland area families. You could go to the beach and you could rent a cabin for the weekend. You could rent a bathing suit for a nickel. You could drive right up onto the beach, as you can see. Certainly has changed over the years. And then, of course, the shoreline itself, the physical nature of the shoreline has changed. And you'll notice even today a variety of ways that the shoreline has been developed and different types of bulkheads, from poured-in-place concrete to the old riprap style to more native. And we'll be getting into that quite a bit more later on in the presentation. A number of the benefits that we all derive from Kirkland's shoreline are manifested in the goals of our existing shoreline management program. And this is just to give you a flavor of what some of those are. And you could certainly, I'm sure, add to these. But the opportunities for family activities, swimming. The lower photo is of the Kirkland Triathlon that was held this past weekend. Opportunities for families to get together for activities, picnicking, and so forth. Community events. It's an opportunity for us to gather as a community to celebrate various events, whether it be things like Summerfest or the 4th of July, those sorts of things. Access to the water has always been a very important goal for our community. Opportunities for non-motorized boating or motorized boating, the boat launch in downtown Kirkland. We also have looked for opportunities to provide ways for people to come to Kirkland by boat. We also have the commercial tour boat program, where we have visitors come to Kirkland as well. Fishing activities. In addition to those things that you might enjoy within the city's park system, and we have a number of parks, as you well know, on the waterfront, we also have, within the city's policies, opportunities for creating public access in those areas where there's mixed-use development or multifamily development. This is an example of a trail along the water's edge on a that looks like a parking garage. Huh? Okay. Natural benefits to the wildlife, the flora and fauna of our community. Fish, the opportunity for water quality. Of course, all of the creeks and water systems in Kirkland eventually end up at Lake Washington. And then finally, the opportunities to live on the lake. We have a number, of course, most of the property is privately owned. Restaurants and other economic development opportunities that the shoreline affords our community. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Patrice to talk a little bit about how Kirkland's doing with providing these benefits.
Thank you. Could I have the laser pointer, please? Well, Michael's done a great job of showing us many of the different benefits that shorelines can provide. One of the great challenges of this project will be to try to balance those many different uses that we want to accommodate on the shoreline. Let's take a look at how well Kirkland Shoreline is doing in providing all these different benefits. Public access and recreation. Well, as Michael pointed out, we actually do have a lot of public access trails already in place and potential for many more. And we have a lot of a wide array of city parks. We saw that in some of the slides, and I want to direct your attention over here to these maps. This first map shows all of the city parks as well as the trails along our waterfront. And we will be continuing to provide more of those, as that's part of the guidelines for the update requirements from the state. So that's doing very well. Nurturing a sense of community, also excellent. There are many events that occur in our shoreline parks throughout the year that bring people together. Movies in the parks, concerts, and as Michael pointed out, Summerfest and other community events. Commerce. It's doing well. There's a wide variety of businesses that grace Kirkland's waterfront. Some examples include the marinas, sailing club, Argosy tours, restaurants, and a variety of businesses in Carillon Point and downtown and elsewhere along Kirkland's waterfront. How about nature in the city? Doing fairly well. The strong visual and tangible presence of Lake Washington and Kirkland is a major component of the natural elements that lend Kirkland its reputation for livability. And most feel that those trees, the lakes and streams, but especially Lake Washington, help maintain that livability despite rapid growth that we've been experiencing. And since 1978, the population of the state of Washington has gained 1 million people about every 12 years. And this trend is projected to continue through the year 2026. So the presence of nature in the city will likely become increasingly important as our community continues to grow. Habitat for fish and wildlife. This is an area that needs some improvement. And why would I say that? Well, one indicator is the fact that Chinook or king salmon is a listed species, listed as threatened, which basically means that if things continue as they have been, it will become extinct. So, and then salmon are very popular for a number of reasons, dining and recreation, commercial fisheries, and cultural reasons with Native Americans, and really an icon for the Pacific Northwest. But even if you don't really care whether the salmon are around or not, they do also serve as an indicator species, sort of the canary in the coal mine. So the fact that their stocks have been declining is an indicator that our environment is having troubles. So we will hear a lot more detail about what's harming the salmon along our shoreline and what we could think about doing about that as Amy takes over in a few minutes. The area of education also needs improvement. We do have opportunities for education along our shoreline. We have guided walks, the Juanita Park Bay Rangers provide guided walks, and there's informational signage also in our parks that describe the history of the area and also tell about the fish and wildlife. Every weekend, our park staff oversees volunteer groups that are working to restore areas in our parks, and they are teaching these folks as they oversee the restoration work. So those opportunities do exist, but there is a lot of room for more. And the more that we can reach people on this, the folks that use Lake Washington and enjoy it and impact it, the better we'll be able to do in the area of habitat as well. One of the first steps in updating the Shoreline Master Program is to do a comprehensive inventory of the shoreline. The City of Kirkland contracted with the Watershed Company for the inventory and analysis, and the maps displayed along the walls here. Can't get the pointer to work, but you see the maps. And they are just a sampling of the maps that are in our inventory, and there are quite a few facts and narrative and charts and so forth in there. And we actually are holding a public comment period from September 1 through October 15th on our inventory, and welcome anyone who is interested in taking a look at that and providing comments back. It's great to get that ground truthing early in the process, and we want to make sure that our information is as accurate as it can be. So see me later if you'd like to get a copy of that. It is online at our Shoreline Management Program website, but we also have it on CD because it takes a long time to download off the website. Those are big files. And we also have some hard copies we can loan out or give you, actually. Now, I guess we should turn it over to Amy Myers of the Watershed Company, and she'll tell us more about key aspects of Kirkland's shoreline conditions.
Thank you. As Patrice mentioned, one component of our shoreline inventory back in March of 2006, still not close enough, we did a physical inventory of the shoreline by boat, looking specifically at elements such as bulkheads, piers, habitat, restoration opportunities, and other sorts of things that are best identified from the water. And as well, the inventory report, which she mentioned, also includes discussion of things like public access, education, and a number of other elements that aren't so water-focused, but also address the fact that the shoreline environment includes the uplands within 200 feet of ordinary high water, as well as any associated wetlands. So those things are also addressed in the inventory. And as Patrice noted in her report card, under Fish and Wildlife Habitat, she has needs improvement. And one of the things that we saw during our inventory is that Kirkland, you know, the good news is that Kirkland has two excellent habitat patches in its shoreline environment. The Yarrow Bay Wetlands is an extensive natural area with, you know, a lot of wetlands and water habitat, very little armoring. And as well, further north, you have the Juanita Bay Wetland Complex that includes and extends eastward up along Forbes Creek. So those two areas have very high fish and wildlife habitat value and function. And what needs improvement is the connection probably between those two areas. Even incremental improvements in the aquatic corridor connecting those two, and then also the upland corridor as well, basically the waterfront area. So I'll talk about that in detail in a few minutes. So I guess I'll first talk about the aquatic habitat. And what I want to show you first is not what we're shooting for. This is not what we're asking anyone to recreate. But it is a good example, and this is St. Edward State Park, of what the lake used to look like. And these are some elements that you can see here that would be good to incorporate as feasible into various properties on the shoreline. So the things I want to point out are the extensive native vegetation. You've got a mix of species, a mix of evergreen species and deciduous species. You also have vegetation that actually overhangs the water. And that has value in that it drops insects and leaves and, you know, other detritus into the lake, and that sort of feeds the food web. And the insects directly feed fish, and leaves and that sort of thing provide habitat for invertebrates and other creatures. You also have some woody debris directly in the water, and that's another habitat element that adds complexity to the near shore and provides fish and wildlife habitat. You don't see any armoring in this picture. Instead, you have a shallow water environment, and the wave action is pretty much attenuated for the most part by the overhanging vegetation, the in-water debris, and, you know, the complex of rocks and shallow water gravels that are in the near shore. Next slide. And underwater, this is maybe what that picture looks like if you're a juvenile fish. There's lots of roots and overhanging debris, sticks and twigs and that sort of thing for juvenile fish to take cover in. And that's a good place for them to get away from predators such as bass. So this is what a lot of the lake looks like now. We have a couple examples here. There's a lot of bulkheads. There's a lot of lawns that go to the bulkhead edge. And then, of course, there's piers. And I've got a bunch of slides like this. A lot of concrete in that picture. So I guess the question that we need to ask is, you know, why do people build bulkheads in the first place? And a number of answers, you know, come to mind. Just general shoreline protection. People feel a need for that. There's a lot of wave action either from, depending on where you are on the lake, the wave fetch can be pretty strong, and you can get some pretty serious waves hitting your shoreline at certain times of the year. Also, boat-generated waves can be a real problem in some areas, too, if people don't respect the no-wake laws in the near shore. Decreasing erosion. Some people feel, you know, that they're actually losing land to a lot of these either storm or boat-driven waves. They want to reduce those wave impacts, so they'll build a bulkhead. And this is more a historical reason that people would do bulkheading, was to increase or maintain the size of their lawn area. So they would just kind of extend, you know, the upland area out into the lake a little bit more and build up a bulkhead and then have a nice level lawn area. And then people also put bulkheads in because their neighbors have them. Either they like the way it looks or they're new to the lake and they see bulkheads on their neighbor's property and think that they probably need one. So I guess we'll talk about fish and how bulkheads impact fish. There's a number of things that bulkheads do that change the nearshore environment. One of them is they decrease the natural gravel recruitment. There's a certain amount of gravel and erosion that does need to occur in the nearshore environment to continually replenish the substrate. Bulkheading, if you have it on some properties and not on others, it can change the wave dynamics and you can end up with actually excessive erosion on an unbulkheaded adjacent property, and that can cause water quality problems. There's something that's sort of known as the wave bashing effect. I don't know what the technical term of that is, but when you have a vertical face and you have deep water in front of it, instead of a natural sloping shoreline where the waves sort of lose energy as they roll up the beach, you can get a very turbulent and rough environment when the waves hit that bulkhead face. And that's not very friendly either to small fish or to children or, you know, any other human being that wants to use that environment. Bulkheads also tend to decrease habitat complexity, not necessarily the bulkhead itself, although that may be true, but oftentimes bulkhead installations are accompanied by removal of nearshore vegetation or any woody debris that may have been in the lake as well. And bulkheads can also increase habitat for predators such as bass or sculpin. In the certain types of bulkheads, there's a lot of large nooks and crannies that the bass or the sculpin can hide in, and those are very good spots for them to lurk, jump out and grab a little chinook that's trying to move along that nearshore environment. So I just got some pictures here. This is wave bashing. doesn't look like a very friendly spot, and this is actually a restoration site that I'll be showing you in a later slide and is part of a tour that is going to be a later shoreline public involvement opportunity. This is an example of loss of complex habitat. You have a pretty uniform wall there. There's not a lot of vegetation, and it's not doing a whole lot for the shoreline. This is an example of bass habitat. You have the large rock in the face of the bulkhead itself. And just to get an idea of, you know, what Kirkland looks like, as part of the inventory, we did a mapping of the different bulkhead and armoring environments, divided it out into the different areas of Kirkland that we analyzed. The PAA is the potential annexation area. We found that 76% of its shoreline is bulkheaded. The residential and urban areas of the city limits are between 82 and 90% armored. And then Juanita Bay and Yarrow Bay, which as I mentioned are the very high functioning wildlife habitat areas, only have 7% armoring. So on average, City of Kirkland has 67% of its shoreline as armored, and 33%, the corollary, is natural or semi-natural. And by that, I'm not talking about being a native natural condition, but just that there is no artificial armoring at the ordinary high water line. So there's a number of design alternatives that people can consider when they're looking at either modifying their existing bulkhead, or maybe they're thinking that maybe they need a new one. And the way that we're thinking about shoreline design these days is trying to put together all the elements of fish habitat, wildlife habitat, and then also consider the human element in terms of making sure that property owners can still use their waterfront. Maybe they use it differently, and depending on the activities that you do on your waterfront, you may actually be increasing your use. Next slide. So some of the design objectives that you might want to think about when you're doing a shoreline restoration are how you can improve water access for yourselves. I'll show you some pictures later, but in many of the environments where you have a bulkhead and then a sheer drop to the lake, it's very difficult to get into the water. It's not safe for kids. You know, I've seen a lot of properties that actually end up fencing off their water so that they don't end up with children in the water. So they're separating themselves from the lake. Depending on your aesthetic, you can also get some improved aesthetics in your shoreline by doing a restoration project. Things to think about also include whether or not you can pull back the bulkhead from the ordinary high water. And a lot of people are already pretty substantially forward into the lake and maybe have 6 feet of depth or even 3 feet of depth. But incremental improvement is a good thing and has value. So even if you pulled back your bulkhead 2 feet, you know, there are gains that would be had fish and wildlife-wise. Decreasing substrate gradient is another thing to think about. We also want to make sure that we reduce erosion. Most of the restoration projects, it is valid to include rock and other hard features because wind and boat-driven waves are a real element in the Lake Washington environment. Consider retaining or planting native vegetation. And then also we want to facilitate the permitting process. As you may know, if you've done shoreline work, not only is the City of Kirkland reviewing your project, but depending on the extent of your project, you may also have the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, Department of Ecology, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers as well. And they all have different regulations, too. So in the restoration benefits to fish and wildlife then from a restoration project include improved refuge from predators. If you introduce some complexity or shallow water, then the smaller fish can be an environment that is not as easy for them to be picked off by the predators. Improved food resources. As I mentioned earlier, Chinook salmon and a lot of other fish rely heavily on terrestrial bugs that fall in from overhanging vegetation. Reduced wave energy is another one, and then just generally improving the migration corridor, not only for juvenile fish moving along the shoreline, but for other wildlife that may use the uplands. So here's some examples of some restoration projects, and these are pretty early after the restoration work is implemented, so the vegetation isn't mature. But you can see that we've got a beach and, you know, access to it. There's vegetation. The bottom picture includes a pier that has a walkway that bridges the near shore, and I'll talk more about piers later. This is a before property, a before picture of a property in Bellevue that is part of the tour that's going to be held, I think, September 30th. As you can see, there's a lawn all the way up to a bulkhead, and then it drops to relatively deep water. And this is the after picture. It includes a beach. It's got habitat elements to provide wildlife habitat. It still has rock to protect the shoreline from erosion, but it's a much friendlier place for fish, wildlife, and for people. This is a Martha Washington Park in Seattle. The before picture is on the left. Again, you have a rather unfriendly boulder bulkhead with ivy and blackberry. And then to the right, you have the restoration site, and it's much friendlier to people. There's a beach. There's down, you know, there's large woody debris. We've got native vegetation. And it's a place I think that humans would enjoy much more than the picture to the left as well. Another example, this is Denny Blaine Park in Seattle. To the left, not very friendly, and to the right, it's good for people and for fish and wildlife. So I want to talk about docks next, and this is an area that the science has been continuing to provide new information over the past few years. I think when we started out looking at piers and their impacts, later in the early 2000s, late 1990s, there wasn't as much Lake Washington specific information, and we had to extrapolate from data in the Great Lakes regions or the East Coast and that sort of thing. But there have been a number of local agencies that are looking at Lake Washington specifically. And so the general consensus is that docks, traditional style, inhibit juvenile migration, and this is juvenile migration of the Chinook salmon along the shoreline for a number of reasons. One would include something like it's what's called a sharp shade line, basically a pier that's wide and is not doesn't have any way for light to get through it. You have quite a contrast between the open area and the area below the dock or to the side of the dock, depending on how the sun is shining. And just like a human coming out of a dark room into a light room or vice versa, initially the fish is, you know, blinded or he's not as well adjusted, and so he's much easier pickings for a bass. Shading can also inhibit aquatic vegetation, and that's sort of a double-edged sword in Lake Washington. There's a lot of invasive vegetation, and we don't necessarily want to encourage that, but aquatic vegetation does play an important role in general productivity of the lake. It does provide cover for juvenile fish and food for a number of other organisms in the lake. Predator habitat as well. There's some connection between piles and bass using the base of those piles as a good place to spawn. And also cover the fish in the can hide behind the wider piles and then do the little jumping out of the juvenile salmon thing again. And then the nearshore habitat in general is compromised. You'd have a lot of very simple structure like piles and overwater cover in the nearshore. You might have boat lifts and other structures as well. So there's a picture of the sharp shade line from the pier. And that's contrasted with this overhanging vegetation picture. And a lot of people say, oh, if you want shade, you know, then my dock is shade. But there's differences in the way that light is filtered through vegetation, generally speaking. It's not a hard line. There's more of a continuum between the light areas and the dark areas, and that allows the fish to adjust. And this is an example of a more traditional dock. There's a lot of wide spaces. There's a lot of areas that are very low to the water, and there's very little light that can get underneath there from the sun. And so there's different alternatives that you can consider when you're remodeling your pier or you're building a new pier. Generally speaking, what all the agencies are looking for is minimization. And so you need to think about reducing the width of different elements of the pier, the main walkway or any L's or fingers that extend off of that. Looking at different ways to allow light to penetrate the dock. Grading is a very popular way to do that. I know different agencies also allow things like prisms or glass blocks. So there's a number of different contracting firms, I think, that are doing a lot of research into different ways to get light through a dock. Increasing the height off the water is another good way to go. That generally only works for the parts of your pier that you're not actually putting a boat next to, so it would be just the parts you use to walk out to your boat, so you don't want your boat, obviously, to slip underneath the dock. Putting the L's or the wider portions of your pier in deeper water is a good idea. There's been a lot of studies about the importance of the nearshore environment, in particular for salmon. So if you can get out into deeper water, it's less important, although it's still actually utilized by juvenile fish. If you can elevate the nearshore walkway, you saw one example already of a bridge that spans the nearshore. Longer pile spans is another way to go. You want to minimize overall the number of piles you use and the size of those piles. It just minimizes the potential for fish to use those as either spawning sites or spots to hide behind. Next slide. So this is an example of one type of grading. This is a fiberglass product. And a lot of people, when they hear grading, they immediately picture the marine application where it's got those metal teeth that sort of grab your feet and they're very uncomfortable. And I know the contractors have been looking a lot into different products, and the fiberglass one I think is actually pretty comfortable on the feet. This is an example of, I think it's Ipe grading. It's a wood product. It's also very comfortable. This is an example of an elevated pier, and as you can see, just even from this picture, there's a lot of opportunity for light to get underneath of that structure. There's another example of a bridge spanning the nearshore environment, and another one, and another one. And this is also shows you a narrow walkway. I think that's probably only 4 feet wide, and that walkway looks like it might be graded with the Ipe decking. And so finally, I want to talk about wildlife habitat, and this is more related to the upland part of the shoreline, sort of making this pretty simple, but simplistically, wildlife need areas for breeding, and so they need spots to nest or to den. They need areas for feeding, not only areas that have food, but perches from which they can go and access the food. And for migrating, what they really need is a corridor that has cover so that they feel safe from predators. So there's a picture of Juanita Bay. You can see the extensive vegetation back there. It's a very large area, and I think the Juanita Bay Park Ranger newsletter at last count had 167 species that have been found in that one area alone. Yarrow Bay in the past has had bald eagles nesting in there. It also has a great blue heron colony, and a large number of waterfowl use that area. And as well, areas like this are great for juvenile salmon rearing habitat. So what can property owners do in terms of wildlife? In general, it's a good idea, if you can, to incorporate native plants into your existing landscaping. And I've got a couple of pictures on the side there of some pretty short of native plants, red flowering currant, salal, and red elderberry. If you can, planting even one large tree that will be suitable for perching along the shoreline, if it's a cottonwood or a Doug fir, something like that, that maybe a bald eagle could perch in. Planting a band of trees and shrubs along the shoreline would also be helpful, of varying widths, and obviously leaving room for views and considering access to your piers and other parts of your property that you enjoy. And then removing invasive species is also a good idea. Those compete with the native species, and they often don't provide the same food and nesting and other habitat benefits that the native plants do.
Thank you, Amy. From what we've heard so far, it seems there are some key actions the city could consider taking that would increase the benefits of Kirkland Shoreline. One would be to do more to foster understanding of how to live with the lake and not just on it. In the next slide, we see that we could also improve. We have so many public properties along the shoreline. There are many opportunities there to aim toward improving habitat over time in those parks and street ends, and also to offer incentives for habitat improvements on private properties as folks apply for permits. So these are all some things that can be considered during the process that we are going to be going through to update the Shoreline Master Program. And so I'll just take a few minutes to talk about what is a Shoreline Master Program. The purpose of it is to prevent harm caused by uncoordinated and piecemeal development of the state's major shorelines. That comes from the state's Shoreline Management Act. The Master Program is made up of policies and regulations for the use and the development of the shoreline. And Kirkland has had its in place, as we've said a couple of times, since the 1970s. Some of the aspects that the Shoreline Master Program regulates is the bulk and dimensions and the locations of structures, site planning, vegetation, shoreline stabilization, that would be the bulkheads and alternatives to bulkheads, docks and moorage, and public view corridors and public trails. Where does it apply? Amy touched on this. This is a diagram. I'm not sure how well you can see it, but this is just not working. So, basically, there's a point on the shoreline that's called the ordinary high water mark, and scientists like Amy have the methodology down to figure out exactly where that point is, and then measured 200 feet landward of that is part of the area, that's the upland area that is covered by the Shoreline Master Program. In this bullet point list, you'll see that lakes 20 acres or larger, and that's where Lake Washington comes in. That's Kirkland has a couple of other lakes, Forbes Lake and Totem Lake, but those are not 20 acres. They're under that. And then also the wetlands that are associated with lakes that are 20 acres or larger, and then that means that as you look at these maps, which do indicate the properties that are covered by the Shoreline Master Program jurisdiction, you'll see that it goes in at Juanita Bay and then again at Yarrow Bay into the extensive wetland network there. All right, on the next slide. You've heard this addressed a couple of times. The shoreline has changed over the years. We have gained new knowledge about how to keep the shoreline healthier. There are new guidelines from the state, and the state requires that we update our Shoreline Master Program to meet those guidelines. It's a good chance for the community to take a fresh look and see what their vision is for the shoreline and make sure that the new Shoreline Master Program will facilitate that occurring on the ground as properties develop and redevelop. And finally, it's an opportunity to help folks understand more about stewardship of the shoreline. What are the likely effects of this update? Well, since Kirkland's shoreline is largely already developed, I'm anticipating that the main effects would be felt when property owners go to build new construction or redevelop what they have. A new aspect of the requirements for the update is that we will be required to assess cumulative impacts as changes are made on the lake. Also, to mitigate impacts. Under the new guidelines, the inventory records what the conditions are now, and that gives us a baseline to work from. So that's why it's really important that this information is as accurate as possible, because according to the new guidelines, if new development would degrade some of the shoreline ecological functions, then people who are developing will need to do some mitigation or improvements along the shoreline for those ecological functions so that we regain that baseline level again. In other words, no net loss as future growth takes place. Endangered species, we've talked about that, and the next three bullet points relate to that: the vegetation, the erosion control versus bulkheads, the docks and piers that Amy was describing and illustrating for us. And then also in the new regulations, or the new guidelines, the state has revised some of the environment designations. And the environment designations are very much like the zones that we have on zoning maps. They describe conditions within a certain area along the shoreline and then prescribe what, by policies and regulations, what should be able to happen there. And then this is, I've copied this chart from the state's Shoreline Master Program website, and on one of your handouts out on the front table, it gives the address of that website. And it's a complicated flow chart, basically working from left to right, and we've already kind of touched on a lot of these things, so I'm not going to go through it at length, but it is, there's a copy of it on your program. And the point I want to make is that we are here shows us we are in the very beginning stages of this. So that's why tonight we're not really going to get into discussions about what might be good regulations or policies. We're just trying to outline what this project really, the scope of it, and give you a sense of it and hear back from you folks what your interests are. My role is to facilitate consideration of all the stakeholders' perspectives and comments, and I just want to let you realize that the bottom bar along there is public and agency involvement, and that is intended to be ongoing from the very beginning of the project throughout even the state review, as after local adoption, when it goes to the state for review and eventual adoption, the state will most likely have another round of public hearings. But I'll just take a moment to tell you, as far as the local adoption process and your involvement, that will be ongoing. The handout about public involvement, the colorful one that introduces the whole project, gives a number of different ways that you can always receive information and give information back to the city. In addition, there are special opportunities. These events in September are the first of those. There's another forum that will be just exactly like this. It will happen on the morning of September 30th, and then on the afternoon of September 30th, which is a Saturday, we'll do the shoreline tour. Then there will be a lull as far as special events goes while we begin to prepare for a series of Planning Commission and Houghton Community Council study sessions, and those should start up in early 2007. That's what we're aiming for. And those are all public, and we welcome involvement in those. We encourage that. After the Planning Commission and Houghton Community Council have had a chance to study and work on formulating these components, then they will eventually be presented to the City Council for final decision. And that we are hoping will happen towards the end of 2007. And after that, then it goes to the state. Let's see. I think that concludes my remarks on this. And I guess just to conclude my remarks altogether, I'd like to direct your attention to that issue sheet. It's not really issues. It's actually the city's interests that we've begun to draft. It's good to start out knowing basically what the objectives are. And there is a handout on the front table, too, that encompasses those. But I just wanted to direct your attention to it, and part of your discussion later on tonight will be an opportunity for you folks to let us know if there are additional things we should consider adding to that list.
And now, I wanted to point out, too, that we've had an opportunity to get some early input from some of the stakeholders, and so that he's not just reflecting the city's thoughts, but also some of the stakeholders' thoughts as well. But it's still a draft, and we're hoping for more input. And we're fortunate to have here tonight Joe Burkhart of the Department of Ecology, who is the review officer for Kirkland Shoreline Master Program. And Joe will give us more information about ecology's role in this project and their main interests.
All right. I just wanted to first of all thank the city for having ecology here as hopefully not just a guest, but along with all of you as partners in this process. I think we've seen some good illustrations tonight of some balancing of different interests along the shoreline, and that's really what the Shoreline Management Act intended. We have a slide here, I think it's probably the next slide, that gives a little bit of legislative context. The Shoreline Management Act was actually instigated by a citizens' initiative back in the early 70s that was for a Shoreline Protection Act, which was actually a more restrictive type of legislation that the legislators took what the citizens' desires and created more of a planning type of legislation that would put planning in the hands of local government with some context or with some guidelines provided by the state. So chapter RCW 9058 is the Shoreline Management Act. What you'll see in the Shoreline Management Act is three sort of common preferences for uses in the shoreline. Patrice mentioned earlier in her discussion that the Shoreline Management Act has balances interests, but there's sort of three different uses that are sort of given priority or higher preference. And I think a lot of people think of the Shoreline Management Act as just environmental protection, but there is reference to protection of water-dependent uses. So those uses such as a shipbuilder or a marina that are dependent on the shoreline. The Act looks sets high priority into protecting these uses. It also talks about public access, preserving public access, both visual and physical access to the shoreline, as well as environmental protection. So if you start to go through the guidelines, which are what the State Department of Ecology has created to implement the Act, you will see these preferences come through in a lot of different requirements and guidance. So the guidelines were essentially redeveloped and were adopted in 2003. Ecology hasn't approved a master program under the new guidelines yet, although there are three programs that are very close to adoption. The City of Port Townsend is probably going to be the first master program that will be adopted statewide, and that should happen real soon, actually within probably the next month or so. So the guidelines are fairly new, and the guidelines are intended for the city to use as some guidance in creating this master program that has local flavor, that has takes into account local circumstances, and really is a product of your community's values and what's important to you about the shoreline, which is, I think, we've talked about a lot tonight. On the next slide, we can see, I was asked to come and talk a little bit about, well, what is ecology's role in this process? And ecology is involved with a lot of the early Shoreline Master Program review in administering grant funds. There's some federal funding that comes from NOAA that is distributed through ecology to local governments to help with some of the technical work, some of the consulting that's required in order to establish this baseline for the master program and to create some of these reports that help give us some guidance. Ecology also provides off and on technical support through, you know, we have a variety of shorelines within the state. So we have hydrogeologists, we have biologists, we have a lot of technical people with a lot of expertise in helping to understand, well, what are the important ecological functions, or what are the important things to protect or preserve or provide a little more help with in all of these communities. And then lastly, I think that the department is responsible for getting involved early, just like all of you have, and being involved in reviewing and commenting on draft reports as well as final master program components. Jim made some opening remarks about setting the schedule for how this master program goes through its different channels and talked about you know the local process and then moving into the state's final adoption. Well, we don't want to be involved only at the end of the process. We want to be able to be involved all the way along so that final approval process, everybody's on the same page, and we're not having a lot of back and forth in terms of what types of elements of the master program are missing or not sufficient. So with that, let's move to the next slide and talk about what Ecology's main interest is in review of shoreline master programs. And a fundamental large part of master program updates is public process, what we're doing tonight, getting people involved to help the local community really identify what those local interests are, what the values of the communities are in their use of the shoreline, and how to reflect that in the master program. So that's a very important step, and I think it's worth noting that Kirkland has a very good-intentioned, ambitious plan for how to involve the public, and it's exciting to see that coming to fruition. Consistency with the guidelines. We're looking at programs statewide, and our main objective is really to protect the public interest. What is the public interest? Well, the Shoreline Management Act refers us back to these preference of uses. So water dependent uses, public access, and protection of ecological functions, so environmental protection based on current science. And then lastly, identification of cumulative impacts. Patrice touched on this a little bit. Just ensuring that regulations that are created in, say, a community like Kirkland, where we understand that a lot of the issues are going to be centered around redevelopment, well, we want to make sure that we're on the same page in terms of how that redevelopment happens in a way if a majority of the shoreline happens to redevelop, that it's done in a way that protects ecological functions and doesn't affect the functions of the shoreline cumulatively or lot by lot, so that it's done with a bigger picture in mind. And then lastly, identifying restoration opportunities, not necessarily proving that they can be implemented, but having a list together that when opportunities do come about, what are the important restoration functions that would fit into this community the best. And then lastly, when we talk about consistency, I think there's sort of a two steps to consistency, both statewide consistency, which we talked about the guidelines, and then regional consistency. So the city of Kirkland deals with shoreline on Lake Washington. There's other Lake Washington jurisdictions that are going to have to go through this similar process. So what Ecology has done is we hold a series of quarterly meetings where we invite regional jurisdictions to come together and talk about what kind of data sources are they using in their inventory? What kind of problems are they running into when they go to use that data, or when they go to, maybe when we move on to regulations and policies? What are some of the common problems that people are foreseeing? What are some of the regulations that make sense to have consistency on a regional basis, so that there is ongoing dialogue and communication between these regional jurisdictions? And then King County is also assisting in that coordination effort sort of on a sub-basin level. So there's a Lake Washington group that is working together, and then there's a Lake Sammamish group that's working together. And so they all try to check in with each other every once in a while just to make sure that everybody's on the same page. That's about it.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you all about a little change in our agenda. Do you want to take a five-minute break? Because you've been such great listeners, or are you kind of eager to just start asking some of the questions that maybe arose? You want to take a couple-minute break? I'm not getting signals from you. You want to take a break? Okay. Let's do that. Let's come back at 8:15 then. Okay. Okay, we're going to start again. So thank you all for being such good listeners during the past hour. And at this point, I want to turn the program over to you. And if you just remember the ground rules, I've got to bring you the microphone so we can make sure that your question or comment gets recorded. So first of all, I just want to ask you, if you'll look at the agenda for a moment, are there any questions you have just to clarify things that any of the panelists said? Then we'll move on to the other questions on the agenda. Did anybody have any questions prompted by things you heard? Okay. Well, why don't you do this first? Why don't you give us your name, and then I'll hold the microphone for you. You can take it.
Tony Fastbind. I'm just wondering how far out the fish zone goes. You said there's a zone along the shore, and then, you know, that you call it a nearshore zone or something.
Nearshore.
How far does that go?
Generally speaking, most agencies sort of consider the first 30 feet the most critical. And then after that, there's sort of a 9-foot depth. It's like maybe a next level of critical, and then it goes, you know.
30 feet out and 9 feet of depth.
Right. Those are kind of the two main benchmarks.
Okay.
But the more studies they've done, they found that juvenile fish actually are using the deeper water more than they previously thought.
You're helping them over here for you.
Yes, my name is Sharon Rodman, and I have a question for Amy about the shoreline inventory.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you assess the severity of invasive species on the vegetated portions of the shoreline.
We didn't directly look at invasive species. We did discuss it when we discussed the different habitat areas, in particular like the Arrow Bay and Juanita Bay. But for the most part, at least the aquatic veg-wise, we didn't discuss it too much. It's actually probably something we need to include more of. So
yeah,
I'll make a note of that.
Anybody else? Any questions of clarification? Okay. Then we'll move to the second question here, and I think the city wants to understand from your perspective what is important about the shoreline to you, or what's important about your property if you happen to live on the waterfront. But we're trying to get a sense of, so what are some of your values, or what are issues that you really care about mostly when you think about the shoreline? That makes sense? Dick.
Yeah, I'm Dick Sandis. I'm a property owner and also a member of an organization called SPOCA, which is a Shoreline Property Owners and Contractors Association, and recently formed to try to work with local agencies on permitting and also, most importantly, basing whatever we do on sound science. Just your reaction to your question, Jim, it's essentially Lake Washington is so unique. It's an urban lake that's got terrific water quality. It's got great access, and living on the east side here and hopefully soon to be annexed into Kirkland, Kirkland has terrific access for the public, so that's really what I value.
Anybody else?
Just a comment session?
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I brought three comments along, pre-written ones I want to talk about. The first one is just in kind of a housekeeping issue, but dirty water in the lake. I live on the lake right down from the city, and there's a city storm drain that runs in right on my property. And every time it rains, the big mud pot, there's a big bunch of dirty water that goes out into the lake, maybe out 50 to 100 feet. It's obviously just like a big mud puddle. All the water from the street in front of my house and from Heritage Park just comes down there and is totally uncontrolled. It just goes out in the water. So I was going to suggest you put in sand filters. I brought an example sheet down here. It's from the EPA. These are simple gadgets that could be built along the shore, I think, to stop the dirty water from going in the lake. You also need to be aware of wildlife. I discovered that that same storm drain is used by the raccoons who live in Heritage Park, and they shuttle back and forth out to the lake through that pipe. There may be a lot of ad hoc type transition zones along the water that you might want to be aware of. Because unfortunately there's a street and their animals are blocked. So this is one way they get out there. Two, I thought about the city could do more, I think, to educate the public. You are in a good position to do that. One thing I didn't understand that was going to happen to me when I moved onto the lake was I was going to become a garbage picker-upper from all the garbage that comes up on the shore. A lot of it from the boats, but also a lot of it from the storm drain. Every time there's a big rainstorm, all the garbage comes out through the storm drain. I pick that up. I also pick up mostly cigarette butts and other items that float up. It turns out that Kirkland City Dock is the most popular boat dock in the city, so maybe a little kiosk there or something in an effort to kind of educate the public about issues on the lake, garbage in the lake, things that boat owners themselves can directly take care of. And then finally, this is more a little complex, but a change in the attitude of the city, I think, to get something done, primarily to become more proactive than reactive. 3 years ago, I tried to get rid of my bulkhead and put in the kind of shoreline you'd like to see, you know, with the nice wavy lines. But it was a very difficult process. Even though I was willing to pay for it, I thought there were a lot of roadblocks thrown up in front of me. Also, the difficulty of integrating this 90 feet of waterfront I have with all the other neighbors. I mean, I could have put in this nice thing, but then what am I going to do, you know, when I have all these bulkheads along? So I think the city could potentially become far more active and actually promote changes, like do the design yourself. Come up with some designs. Form something like SIDS, what I would call a shoreline improvement district, you know, like we have LIDS right now. These are expensive. It was going to cost anywhere between $500 to $2,000 per shoreline foot to put in the kind of improvements that the city would like to see. These are big numbers. In my case, it could be anywhere from $50,000 to $200,000 just for one lot. You multiply that by all the lots up and down the city, and you're talking about huge amounts of money. I think if the city wants to see this happen, you're going to have to join in with the owners. Otherwise, what you're going to get is what you're getting now, which is piecemeal improvement. He showed some examples of these nice little natural shoreline examples, but they're very rare along the lake. If you go around the lake, you only see a few of them. People very motivated to do it, or they happen to have the right kind of lot. It's just otherwise not going to happen. In 15 years, we'll be redoing the Shoreline Management Act. You will have made small improvements rather than the kind of large improvements that are potential with a far more active role. Part of that, I think, is the city needs to accept more responsibility for their ownership on the lake. They have a lot of land. The city owns a lot of docks. The city owns a lot of bulkheads. The city is just as big a center, I think, of anybody else on the lake in terms of, you know, having kind of this man-made approach to the lake rather than a natural approach. So there's a lot you could do. You could join in with the homeowners. You could, you know, make a goal of actually improving the lake, putting it back to a natural state. Take many years, but with the homeowners are interested in this. The homeowners do pay a lot of attention to what goes on in the water. They live right there. We get all the benefits of the land and the wildlife and all of that. I think you might find them more accepting of change with a different kind of attitude from the city rather than I come in there and want to get a permit, and then you say, well, you can't do this and you can't do that. And I say, well, what about my neighbors? Well, we don't have any control over them. And so it's limiting right now, and that's why things are happening so slowly. And then one thing I added here, somebody said they wanted to simplify the permitting process. You can look around the other lakes. When I was going to work on my dock, I happened to call Mercer Island to find out what they do or what they recommend, and they're far further along than Kirkland. Kirkland doesn't have dock plans. They just kind of, you know, ad hoc it dock by dock. Mercer Island's far ahead. They had, you know, a preemptive list or a list that I could go to and I could meet it, and then I could get my dock permitted very, very quick. You know, so look around the lake. I think some of the other communities are further along than Kirkland is, and you might get some good ideas there. So that's it for me.
Anybody else want to expand on what you said in terms of education or the city's own actions or learning from others? But anybody else have any other comments or issues you want to urge the city to consider?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sure talking about what I liked about the lake earlier, but I think one thing really needs to be underscored, and that is what's happened under the Shoreline Management Act since 1972. But for that act and but for leadership in the city, both policy council members and staff, you wouldn't have what we have today, the Carillon Point situation where we have public access but a good economic thing for the city, lots of access along the lake, things that might have been developed differently, like over-the-water apartments, no longer could be permitted, and that's a good thing, amongst many other good things that happened. So, in talking about restoration, it really needs to be thought about in the context of the 30 years of the Act, not just beginning today, because so many good things have happened. Now, as just was mentioned earlier, yeah, there's other things. A lot of improvements can be made, everything from stormwater runoff to improvements in designs and other things, and those will be very welcomed as well. But I just think it's important to recognize this is an urban lake. Kirkland's probably got more access per square foot per capita, however you want to measure it. Looking at the inventory, there's some interesting percentages there. Even with the bulkheads, some 33% of the waterfront is unbulkheaded, which is a pretty good percentage for an urban situation. If you extend the distance up to St. Edward's Park, which is contiguous to what will be the annexed area, that number would even go up even more. So for an urban setting, there are natural habitats. It is something that I think really ought to be kept in mind as we move ahead. And I want to underscore, once again, the organization SPOCA that I'm representing, as well as my own interests as a property owner. We want to work constructively on this process, and we welcome the opportunity. And thank you for this effort. I know it takes a lot of work to put these sessions on, and it's a long road ahead. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Anybody else? I'm kind of loosely going by the agenda, but thinking about, are there any other interests you want to articulate that you have? Are there any issues, perhaps, that none of our panelists have really raised that you think should be incorporated into this process? Anything like the way Dick was just talking to about any of the values or kind of really important characteristics that you want to take this opportunity to it? Kind of urge the city to think about or make sure to protect or preserve?
Yes, I really like the concept of improving the habitat for wildlife and fish and birds and humans. And I really love those before and after pictures of the bulkheads and then the more natural environment, and how actually it was better for humans. So we realize we're doing it for humans and the other animals. And then I also really like the stewardship and public education aspects. I think those are very important. It would be nice if all the neighbors were doing the natural shoreline, because the other neighbors were.
Anybody else?
Yeah.
Oh.
Just a quick comment on that. I'm Debbie Nadelson. I'm coordinating the shoreline tour, and that's what we're hoping to achieve, is that neighbors learn best from other neighbors. So we love that thinking, and we're hoping that you'll all come and get some ideas and inspiration and tell your fellow shoreline property owners and businesses to come along.
This is kind of a question. I'm just wondering, has there ever been any thought to kind of a amenity or incentive plan with, you know, with respect to not necessarily single family development on the shoreline, but with any kind of commercial or mixed use development, where if you, you know, implement some of these restoration plans or just, you know, go ahead and use some of the more conservative approaches as far as bulkheads and things, you know, any kind of not armoring the shoreline, that you could gain other incentives? Is that used in Kirkland, or is that ever considered?
We don't have anything in place yet, but I have been exploring this because I'd like to pursue incentives with the Shoreline Master Program. And so far, the most viable one that I've heard of is Port Townsend's approach, where they are considering giving developers, folks who are doing development or redevelopment, some breaks, some special considerations, some variances from the code requirements, the basic standards, in cases where they are providing some of the restoration. It's really not restoring, you know, we're not talking about going back to pre-settlement times, but improvements for the shoreline functions. And I think that the way they have set it up is that if someone is applying to have this special incentive granted to them, speedy process and some breaks from some of the standards, then it would be reviewed by a committee that would include agency folks like Fish and Wildlife to make sure that the trade-offs are good ones all the way around.
I just think that a lot of times then people don't feel so much like they're just being forced to give up something.
Yes.
And you know, that there are trade-offs that where you're not going to be impacting the environment or public access or any of the, you know, mm-hmm. the values that are in the Shoreline Management Act, that the developers and property owners can gain something to advantage to them, and it's kind of a win-win situation.
I'm hoping we can include that.
My name is Mark Nelson, and I thought a little bit what my neighbor Tony Fassbein said, and it prompted a question which maybe can't be answered tonight, and maybe it's already been answered. I did read the document that's been prepared thus far by Watershed, and one of the thoughts I had, I live next to a much larger storm sewer outflow than Tony does, and I have often wondered about the impact of the stormwater runoff into the lake on the kinds of things that are talked about in the watershed report. So the question is, has there been any work and is there any science relating the effect of stormwater runoff, which basically comes from all up here as it heads down to the water, and there's a number of outflows into the lake. Has there been any studies done concerning the stormwater runoff and the impact on the kinds of things that were talked about earlier? And for instance, if you could spend $1 million, would it make better sense to spend $1 million to do something about the stormwater runoff rather than, for instance, to do something with the shoreline and getting rid of the hard walls? And if that was addressed in the watershed report, just tell me and I'll look at it. But it seemed to, I think there was a reference to stormwater, but it wasn't very clear to me. And I've often wondered about it because this time of year, especially after it's been dry all summer and so forth, when you see what goes into the lake, there's a lot of stuff off of the streets and so forth. So I've always wondered about it.
That's a big question. So I guess
it's in the report. Just tell me.
It kind of is, and it kind of will be in a later component. The restoration plan component, it'll be discussed more there. Part of why it wasn't discussed in detail is that the inventory report is more just a straight report of what is, and then a lot of what's happening stormwater-wise is occurring outside of shoreline jurisdiction, and so yes, and within shoreline jurisdiction too. I haven't run across any specific studies on stormwater impacts in Lake Washington. I know there's a lot of studies on stormwater impacts in streams and rivers, and primarily, you know, partly because of water quality, but also the larger impact of water quantity. And on the lake, water quantity isn't the issue. But generally, the water quality studies, as a couple people have mentioned, for Lake Washington, the reports are good. But locally, definitely at those outfall points, I'm sure there's all kinds of damage being done. Who knows, you know, what's in the substrates and those, you know, those areas in terms of hydrocarbons and obviously sediment and that sort of thing. You could have, you know, some very acute short-term turbidity problems that would impact fish. The restoration plan component that's going to come later, by restoration plan, a lot of people think that that component is going to be a plan that you look at and it's got plants and that sort of thing, but it's a bit of a misnomer. It's more a restoration program, and it encompasses all of the things in the watershed and then back down to the city level that are going on to impact the Lake Washington environment and the city's shoreline. And so that's the place where we talk about different things like stormwater programs and what could be done there, what should be done there. That's where we also might talk about big picture things like more about what's going on with WIRA 8 planning, you know, and any other programs that, you know, that go on locally as well. So we're going to be dealing with that more, and they'll probably look for more studies at that time, but it isn't addressed in depth in this report. You're right. But it is important.
I might jump in here, too. I'm Paul Stewart with the Planning Department. And Mark, you might want to check with the Public Works Department. There is a surface water master plan that's been put together by Public Works, and that addresses maybe some of the things you're talking about. We're kind of trying to dovetail as much as possible, but that's one source you can go to and find out more about that particular situation. Same thing with you. Right. But I also think, I mean, the water quality, correct me if I'm wrong, Amy, is not too bad in Lake Washington.
Right.
So turbidity may be another issue where the outfall comes out is another thing. But overall, the water quality is fairly okay in Lake Washington.
It's probably going to be a very local, acute problem at the outfalls,
I wanted to make another comment. You talked about incentives on the shoreline. My particular experience, basically, I think what the lake, or the people that are in, want to improve the health of the lake, want to see is a wavy shoreline, what I call a wavy shoreline, instead of a straight line, linear shoreline like we have right now. So in my case, I wanted to remove my bulkhead and put in one of these wavy shorelines. The deal killer for me was the requirement that all inlets and things had to be on my property. I could not move out into past the mean water high line, which means that I'm 15 feet from my house to the water, from my bulkhead, and there's quite a drop-off already. It was just infeasible. I would have been willing to go average, you know, like, okay, I'll move out into the lake, and I'll come in, and we'll do this, and I'll have an average same amount of land as I did before, but that was not allowed. I noticed all the examples on your screen here of improvements showed the new beaches or whatever being on the water side, or the land side. Never was the lake shore pushed out, and that's what would have to happen. I think if, you know, somehow the city could be, or the people involved could be more flexible on that, you'd get more done. So I just couldn't go to my neighbors with that. My plan was, okay, I'm going to, you know, put together a master plan, go to my neighbors, four or five of us, because we're just bulkhead row down there right off the city, and get everybody to change this. But, you know, nobody's interested in losing their lawn. Nobody's interested in losing their land there. It's extremely expensive land if you haven't priced it down there lately. And, you know, so I think flexibility in that regard, that would have been a great incentive for me, that, you know, what I would call Nut Lake area stays the same rather than the current, where my understanding of the current example or requirements are that the lake is always going to get bigger, you know. So just averaging out the lake and keeping the area the same would have helped a lot. Thank you.
Anybody else have any other issues you want to add or any concerns or interests you want to articulate? Going once, going twice? So actually, for me, I've heard a couple of things that I hadn't heard from the city in terms of adding issues, like the emphasis on restoration, the use of incentives, learning from other cities like Mercer Island. Because I remember when I first met you, Patrice, you were talking about how can we not always reinvent the wheel but learn from others. And here you've mentioned Mercer Island, one very close to home. So those are some of the issues that I've heard you say tonight that I don't think that the city has yet articulated or had earlier this evening. Is there anything else you want to add tonight? Yeah, Mark?
To the extent you're comfortable answering, you said Port Townsend looks like it's going to be approved, perhaps, and I know how that goes. Would you recommend that that's something that we all ought to take a look at? Is there good stuff to be gleaned from that, or because it's a saltwater, very different kind of community, would you say don't waste our time?
Well,
just any thoughts on
that? Yeah, sure. No, I appreciate that. I think it is it's a different environment in terms of some of the specifics. It's an area that is probably in a little different position than Kirkland. And to tell you the truth, I'm not as familiar with their plan to know a lot of the specifics of it. But hopefully, with that being adopted, with the Port Townsend plan being adopted, that there's going to be some more guidance that comes out and taken from that and showing some real world examples on how to apply these guidelines in different areas.
I'm Greg Ashley, Principal of Shoreline Design and Permitting. My basic question is the city going to form any advisory committees to help rewrite these rules, or are you just going to rely on the your in-house people to write them and just take public comments?
We thought about using an advisory committee, and we thought for this project that might not be a good fit for a couple reasons. One is that typically with advisory committees, using that way to write things has added an additional year to 2 years to the process. And I personally am a fan of trying to keep the process rolling efficiently, because I think it's a lot to expect stakeholders to stay engaged for longer than a year in something, and to make it last for 3 or 4 years is just an awfully long time. Also, I think it's challenging when you have committees like that. Oftentimes you end up with some personalities that are stronger than others, and so some viewpoints end up being emphasized more than others. So what we've been trying to do here instead is to we will begin putting materials in front of our planning commission so that they can begin to formulate, do some thinking and begin to draft up some things, but always in public meetings, always in study sessions. So we're hoping that people will stay engaged and work in partnership through this whole process.
I add something to that, too. We'd like to get some ideas on how to get the word out as much as possible to people. And some of you may have seen the signs or got the mail out or saw it on the web. But if you got some ideas how to talk to your neighbors or get more information to people, please let us know, because we want to get as many people involved as possible.
It may be on that score, too. I think Patrice will reemphasize this as you take back the microphone in a couple minutes. But there's going to be the same forum again Saturday morning, a week from this Saturday, September 30th. And if you can help get people to come to it, any of your friends or neighbors or people that you think would be particularly interested, we'd love to have you help get the word out, too. Okay. Anybody else? Or should I, if you don't have any more questions or comments or interests or issues you want to articulate tonight, I'm going to hand it back to Patrice. Okay. We're going to also do a quick summary report, too, that we can send to all of you of tonight's forum, too. And I guess I want to also acknowledge one other issue that Tony mentioned that I hadn't heard from the city, which is the need for flexibility in design and thinking about that, too. So your different interests and issues and things like that will be in my report and the report that we're putting together, too, which will help to, again, say, well, what did the citizens tell us really needed to be incorporated as a list of issues or interests into this process? Any other comments, questions? Yeah, Tony?
I think you're going to find that most of the property owners are pretty highly interested in these issues, and they will help you improve the lake. I think for the most part, most property owners want to see the lake be better. I mean, why wouldn't they? And I think you would find that they would get rid of their bulkheads and they would redesign their docks and it will do all these things that would help the lake be healthier with more of an outreach program. But it's difficult right now with the current program of the permitting process and all. Basically, that's a static type thing. It holds back people from doing bad things. There's no encouragement for people to do good things. So, you know, it's a limitation to the process right now.
So, Patrice, do you want to wrap it up this evening and kind of explain again the different points of public involvement in the process? I think that's how you wanted to end it this evening.
Sure. If we can roll back to that, forward to the last slide. It's actually the same chart that you saw before. And I just want to reiterate, I think you've heard this several times. Please do grab handouts if you didn't get them, because some of those handouts will summarize for you all the different ways that you can remain involved. If you have any suggestions for additional ways that we could make that better, love to hear them. I'm the project manager, and you should feel free to contact me. And with that, I just want to, most importantly, I just want to thank you very, very much for coming tonight, for giving your valuable time to hearing about this project and to giving us input to make it a better outcome. So thank you for coming.
With that, we're adjourned.